now where people like it. So why would anybody switch? We like it. We keep eating the same thing.
Well, this is actually something maybe I could put on the podcast. I just hit the record button, so I don't know if I'll air this or not. But so if you go back to for Coca-Cola, 1986, I think, is when they came out with the new Coke. Bill Cosby hit was on TV with it, and it was a horrible, horrible failure. And then the CEO later on down the road, he said, because they ended up bringing back the old, and then of course they brought it named as Coca-Cola Classic. They were in a blind taste test. Pepsi, people would rule, Pepsi would taste better than Coke. But Coke was still outselling Pepsi. I think they're still outselling them to this day. But so they ended up, there's a huge customer backlash when they said, we're going to have the new Coke and your old Coke is going away. It's going to be a sweeter. It's actually in countless surveys. It's people love it. And people were calling in saying, you're taking my childhood memories away. It was a fascinating business case. What are your thoughts on that? Like, it was a fascinating business case study.
Vinny?
Do you think it was like, you think it's sentimental that there was a backlash or?
Well, my opinion that, since you're asking, I mean, certainly the advertising, but they have a mind share that was so, it's so iconic and to America. I mean, you can trace it back in World War II where the CEO, Robert Woodruff, he would send free Coca-Colas to all the GIs fighting around the world in World War II. And it's something just like Chris said with the C earlier, the advertising, I think, was just such a huge component with Coke. And I'm not sure if I can explain all the reasons, but it took off huge and ever since in the late 1800s. And it's part of America, it seems like. Now it's declining. It's not going to be in 50 years. Who knows how many people will be drinking it. But it had a good 100-year run, which is amazing for just some colored sugar water.
I thought the question was about why.
Yeah,
why
so that specific example, you had this huge customer backlash that you're taking it away, even though supposedly the new one tasted better, and just wanted to put that question to both of you.
I don't really know the empirical, I don't really know the history of it very much. I mean, do they really do enough focus groups and things like that to, did they really do enough taste testing to make sure? I mean,
supposedly they did. Taste testing. And the Pepsi, they would do commercials. I remember as a kid.
I'm not talking about Pepsi, though. I thought you were talking about the new Coke.
The new Coke. So in the 80s, the competitor, I'll get to both. So the new Pepsi would always have the blind taste test on their commercials. And from what I read, that it's true. Even Coke admitted that in a blind taste test, Pepsi would win. And so their sales were starting to come down a little. Coke, they're still outselling Pepsi in the 80s. And so they did away with the entire, after 100 years, the recipe and said, now we have the new Coke. Bill Cosby did a commercial on it. I remember when it came out. And there's a huge backlash. People didn't want the new Coke. They did away with the new Coke within 3 or 4 years or something. But there was a big sales increase when they brought Coca-Cola Classic on. And just, what are your thoughts on why... In that particular example, people were so upset. Brand power. See,
you're bringing Pepsi into it, but was there a comparison test taste between classic Coke and new Coke? What was the? I'm not saying you would necessarily know this offhand either, but how much? I mean, maybe they just didn't test adequate. I mean, then if they did a lot of taste testing, and then it happened anyway, where people ended up not liking it as much, then that's a more interesting question. But if they just didn't do enough adequate taste testing,
I think the fascinating question is the brand power. Why are people so emotionally part of the brand Coca-Cola? And then you could apply that to so many other brands.
It was still the brand Coca-Cola. I mean, you're saying it's the change itself. You're thinking is the fact that they changed it is what.
No, I was asking a question. What created that brand? Why are people so emotionally attached to it that they'll voluntarily pass up a better tasting alternative?
Oh, I see.
That's a fascinating question, I think.
Right. Again, I mean, I think the Pepsi and the Coke Classic are different. I mean, Pepsi and the new Coke.
Let's assume they did all a large sample size. Coca-Cola did, and you know, I think that's the case. And then Pepsi. They in the blind taste test, they always would. I don't know the numbers. Maybe it was like 60-40, or I'm not saying it was 90-10. They picked Pepsi, but So let's say they did the requisite. So let's just bracket all that out and let's assume they did that.
I think with the Coke and at least with Coke and Pepsi, I mean, I think that you're probably right. Is Coke just had these associations. It's just like, they're already, you know, they're already, people would call it, you know, give me a Coke, give me, you know, if you say, give me a Pepsi, well, that's.
Yeah,
you
know, just the name itself, it's so ubiquitous. It's incredible, really.
Right.
You know, I remember this story pretty well, actually. And this is how I thought of it at the time. It actually was a little more complicated. Coke did a very long, drawn out, like, phase out of the original. And so they told everybody, we're switching to the new Coke. As you said, the new Coke was to taste like Pepsi. That was the whole point of new Coke. And they were losing market share. And so they told people, listen, we're going to make this switch and we're going to phase it out. But it wasn't like they just switched it out overnight and all of a sudden all the old Coke was gone. So what they actually did is, you know, accidentally or on purpose, is they created scarcity, which of course is a fundamental driver of behavior. Mm-hmm. And so there was still regular Coke on the shelves, but it was hard to come by. And so you could still get it once in a while. So people were actually running to the grocery store to buy up the last cans of Coke. So I think you have to really segment the population. There are those individuals that did in fact say, yeah, I like the new Coke, it tastes fine. Plenty of people said that. But, and they said they like it better. But there were those people who liked the old Coke better, who probably were not buying a lot of Coke because they were relatively indifferent to Coke. But once you told them that there wasn't going to be Coke anymore, okay, right? Suddenly, their desire to buy the product is dramatically amplified. So the two groups, the new Coke people were like, okay, I'll buy some new Coke, but I'm not really motivated to buy new Coke. Pepsi was already there. But people who liked the old Coke, well, now they're on steroids in terms of their behavior. There was by maintaining the scarcity for months, okay, they drove up the value of it. So, and then secondly, to your point, I do think that Coca-Cola had achieved, you know, much more than Pepsi, because of age, had achieved just this status of, this is just what the family buys. Right, there are Coke families, there were Pepsi families. This is clear. There were Coke families and Pepsi families, and that's what you bought. So you had this little. It's basically a lot. It's probably akin to, you know, White Sox versus Cubs or Yankees versus the Mets. The difference is, the Yankees fans had just gotten used to, you know, the Yankees winning a lot or just didn't care. weren't buying tickets until you told people the Yankees were gonna be gone. And they're going to have to watch the Mets. Okay, that's what happened. So but the beauty of it is, as far as Coca-Cola is concerned, is they never had they create a new brand, Original Coke. It was just Coke.
Yeah.
Now it's Original Coke. Now it's special. And that lasted a really long time. And I don't know that it's so. I think they got people who had stopped drinking soft drinks to start drinking again.
Well, so are you saying that was a deliberate strategy, or you're just saying that's just what happened? They just benefited.
I think there are two components. The slow phase out was deliberate. I don't think they anticipated that people were going to be like, oh, I've got to have my Original Coke. But in retrospect, the psychology of what they did, you know, is you couldn't have designed it better to get people to say, wait a minute. If you just gotten rid of Coke, Original Coke, right? They would have had no choice. They just would have been mad at you. Mm-hmm. But by leaving the Original Coke there, you had people going to the stores trying to buy it up. It became a commodity. The notion was they were going to buy it. They were going to, what's the word? Sit on it, right? For years. They had their stash. That if you start buying anything for the next 5 years, You, how many times did you increase their sale? They normally buy for the week, right? The ones who buy it. But add in the people who weren't buying because they kind of, you know, it, but they don't want it to go away. And now they're trying to buy 5 years worth of Coke. And this was because people, now here's the thing. Not everybody had 5 years worth of Coke money to spend. Let's be honest. A lot of people they have a couple months of Coke money. So they spend a couple months. Some people had 10 years of Coke money. There were people who had they had turned their bomb shelter into a Coke storage facility. So I think that's why they had such a big kick, because in their sales is that people were no longer buying for the week. They were buying for lifetime supply. So you just forwarded all those sales, right? You got all those sales for 5 years to start to materialize in, or at least months, start to materialize in weeks. But at some point they were going to have a fall off on that. The way they mitigated the fall off is scarcity. Once they knew people wanted the original Coke, they still kept making the new Coke, and they made less of the original Coke. They made you fight for it.
But what is it? What does he think that why Coke was dominant in the first place? Maybe it's the name?
So
and the advertising? Well,
I think you have to start off, you know, with the fact that there was a time when there was only Coke. There was no alternative. So I'm sure people came up with some other fizzy water things pretty soon. Don't forget, when Coke first started, also it had cocaine in it.
Yeah.
So it was addictive. And I think that, you know, and they, and of course, they probably over the years, you know, they would have they branded themselves with everything Americana, right? Yeah. So if you go back and look at their advertising campaigns for, you know, 100 years, you know, they were like apple pie and mom, right? They if you look at their imagery from their advertising, they constantly put themselves in that category of, you know, it's just every good memory, you know, your time with granddad, right? You had to have Coke. I mean, so absolutely. And then it's a circular situation, right? And then you actually did buy Coke when you sat down with your granddad. And then you did have memories with having your granddad having Coke. So it was obviously fantastic position that they were in, but they were losing market share. They did make new Cokes taste like Pepsi. And they activated a latent population of people who did not want to see it go away.
Well, the next interesting question is why don't people really drink Coke anymore?
Health.
Yeah.
Concerns.
How about you? Any thoughts? Or that's what I was gonna say as well.
Well, I agree with that on that part. I was just thinking more about, I mean, I was still thinking about Coke and it's the dominant, because I just think in terms of language, for some reason this topic interests me about how certain brands become identified with the product itself. So Kleenex is one example, for example. Kleenex, you know, it's just like, give me a Kleenex. People say that. You know, it's like, give me a facial tissue. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it becomes a verb for the, like Google, instead of saying search.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's certain other brands, Xerox, Post-it. And so it comes up a lot with office supplies, liquid paper. You know, it's, well, Whiteout is another, that one had two, actually. I guess Whiteout was actually, became more identified with that. But you still don't say, what is it? Give me some white correction tape or something. What is that? Give me some correction fluid. Does anybody say that ever? Yeah. Well, TiVo, but then TiVo, I think, you know, they weren't able to maintain that. So people's, you know, people's talked about TiVoing this or that, but then no longer, you know, that's no longer the case. So that was short-lived, I guess. DVR, people just got used to saying DVR. But Kleenex and Xerox is still, you know, I don't even know if they have the dominant share anymore. Xerox of copiers. I mean, there's so many other competitors, you know, like HP, Canon, all that stuff. But and I'm sure they're doing pretty well still, Xerox. But I mean, especially like around the time we were growing up, like Xerox this or Xerox that. I mean,
yeah.
It was a verb. It was, you know, Xerox machine, whether it was a Xerox brand or not. To me, that's just fascinating that people start to identify, you know, a particular brand name with them. So I think to some extent they did that with Coke. I mean, people speak of soda, But really, I mean, soda's kind of weird because it's just like soda kind of has something to do with the 50s and ice cream and something also. So it's never really clear to me what soda is. And then you have people from certain parts of the country, they call it pop. Yeah. But I mean, or soda pop or something. But I mean, Coke, everybody will say, you know, give me a Coke.
In the South, they say a Coke, right? In the North, they say a pop.
Right. And also, I mean, what you said about families, that also triggered a memory, Chris, because my sister used to babysit for one of the neighbors, and they were also about Pepsi, which struck me as strange. You know? But the whole family, they just drank Pepsi. That's what they bought was Pepsi. Give me a Pepsi. Right. So it's just a familiar thing where, I mean, we always had Coke. You were pretty, I mean, my parents had a lot of parties, and you were pretty safe serving Coke, I think.
Right.
If you had only Pepsi, that would be. If you have only Coke, you're probably okay. But if you have only Pepsi, that might be a problem. Only right. Dr. Pepper. People like their things. Dr. Pepper. I think Sprite did pretty well too because it was different. People had this kind of somewhat strange
Coke
idea.
You're right. Coke is a safe bet. But you know what's funny? If you look at Pepsi, they advertised as the drink of the taste of a new generation.
Yeah.
So they were quite aware of that they had to somehow balance out Coke's dominance as the you know.
Although Diet Coke,
nostalgic one,
Diet Coke did pretty well. Remember that with those commercials with Telly Savalas just for the taste of it and all that stuff.
Oh yeah, you know it's funny. Beer commercials were the other category that was really, really fierce commercials in the '80s. I remember really fierce competition among the. Apparently, the beer companies got together and tried to do basically a ceasefire. and then recently. Basically it was a non-disparagement type of agreement that they made instead of attacking each other anymore. So, I mean, I think this is in the 80s commercials were very like, it was a real war.
Well, yeah. And having a good jingle, like just for the taste of it, that was a catchy jingle and that really did well. Diet Coke. That was, I mean, it wasn't, I don't know how innovative. I mean, I think Tab came before Diet Coke or something, but it's kind of late.
Tab was back in, well, at least I remember it from the 70s. It might be earlier. But Tab tasted horrible.
But Diet Coke was kind of a late comer, but they did really well, right? I mean, as far as I can remember.
Which one?
Diet Coke.
Yeah, it was definitely late compared to Tab.
I mean, they did really well. I think they probably dominate that particular share of the market, too.
I think Pepsi came out first and then Diet Coke, but then Diet Coke ended up becoming first, yeah.
What was first, Diet Pepsi?
I think Diet Pepsi came out first. They had first mover advantage.
Well, right. No, I just meant as far as though dominating market share, I think Diet Coke took over pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, that's because, interesting you mentioned beer because Budweiser was almost the closest analog to Coke. And people really, the market share is going down pretty dramatically every year for Budweiser. It used to have a huge... stability there on market share, and it's the last few years you've got so much more many, I don't know if it's millennials or the go into local beers, and then of course you have the wine and other categories, but Budweiser is going down like Coke quite a bit as well per capita, and at least in North America.
Yeah, you know, I think there are dramatic shifts in culture. I mean, back in the 70s, we still had a country where you still had people who had worked for companies for a long time, and the CEO would make 50 times the average employee salary, and they would work in factories, and you know, that was a good life, right? You know, you worked hard during the week, and then you went home and enjoyed your family, and people worked for big corporations, and big corporations were seemingly more benign, seemingly anyway. And now I think we perceive big corporations as having very strong interests and that they're focused on not just returns, you know, not on what, you know, it used to be, used to get a dividend, right? If you're an investor, not on dividends, but you know, people hold stock to sell the stock, and that the executives are really focused on their bonuses or on getting as much salary as possible. So I think that it almost makes sense that people nowadays say, you know what, I don't have to buy it from a big corporation, right? I'm gonna brew it in my garage, okay? I mean, it's all because people don't. Because I think you had a situation where before where people felt a lot of allegiance to their company. If I was a Ford, worked on a Ford assembly line, I felt I had a lot of pride in being a Ford guy, probably. And Ford was going to pay me my pension, you know? And I think that's the kind of the connection between worker and corporation that has changed. And consequently, I think that's what drives this notion that why should I buy the family? Like for instance, families were Coke families, but they were also, you know, Chrysler families. Mm-hmm. Every car was a Chrysler, mm-hmm. right? We'll never buy the other guys, okay?
Yeah.
Who knows where that came from? But, or you know, families were like that. There was a lot of allegiance to a lot of things. And I think that that is the thing that's changed. So I don't think anybody says, there are still families, I'm sure they're, you know, Volkswagen families, whatever. But I do think people are more open to being convinced to buy another company's product now based on, you know, consumer reports, based on ratings, based on, you know, the data, as opposed to out of just loyalty.
What do you think that is? Is internet or other areas beyond that? Or
I think that there's a general view that companies don't have loyalty back. So why would you participate in this one-way loyalty street, right? So that's why, so the sense is if companies aren't taking care of workers, then I might as well buy from the guy with the microbrewery, right? Because at least I can see that this guy will use that money to pay his bills.
Why do you think that doesn't extend to sports? Because I kind of question why people are such huge, oh yeah, I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan. I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan, or you could say, you know, LA Lakers or any team, but you could have a star player playing for that team. And then like Kevin Durant with the Oklahoma Thunder, he leaves. Now he goes to Golden State. You know, now he's in Brooklyn. Like you've got this loyalty with sports fans, but the players don't have loyalty.
Well, it's not as extreme. Remember, most cities only have one team, right? They don't have, you can't choose from five teams in your city. You know, you've got to choose, you got a team in your city. But I would argue that the loyalty of fans to their teams has dramatically decreased. Not to the level which you're talking about with those other things, but I think people are willing to shop around for their favorite team now. I think people will show up and say, I'm a Kansas City fan, more than they would before. Before you couldn't do that. You know, you couldn't show, I mean, when I was a kid, I remember moving to Texas and I had been, you know, living in Virginia, so I was a Washington Redskins fan. Even as a little kid, I knew I couldn't just become a Dallas Cowboys fan. Okay. In fact, because I moved to Texas and because the Washington Redskins were kind of on a downhill slide at the time, I remember rooting for the Denver Broncos against the Dallas Cowboys because the Dallas Cowboys were the enemy of the Washington Redskins. Okay. So, I mean, I couldn't switch, right? I think that's totally different. I was a little kid. So I think that nowadays, it's much more common and okay for you to change your team.
But that's another interesting question as far as people have loyalty for Coke, where the Dallas Cowboys is, you know, I'm sure it fluctuated over the years, but the most recent data I've seen is the Dallas Cowboys is the most valuable football brand in the world. Yeah. And then in New York, the Yankees have been like that for decades. Like, why? Yeah. You see these patterns, beverages, sports teams. Where does that loyalty come from? And there's something in our DNA.
I think this has been studied, but I mean, I think in general, if you look at the pattern of loyalty, if you live in a city with a team like Houston, okay, take the Houston, now they're the Houston Texans.
Okay.
used to have the Houston Oilers franchise there, different franchise, but regardless, if you look at the map, right around Metro Houston, they are Houston fans. Outside of Metro Houston, they are Cowboys fans in Texas. So every city, every team has, you know, their loyal, their base. But in between the base of other cities, it's the Dallas Cowboys. Dallas Cowboys are desirable everywhere. Now, these we call America's team. That's consistent, right? But I think the reason it is, and they've written about this, people know better, I don't disagree, is that the cowboy represents independence. You know, the cowboy is out on the range, right? The cowboy isn't locally restricted. America has a love affair with cowboys, right, going way back. So to the extent that you have people in between areas, they gravitate towards what feels like the American ideal. It's like the Marlboro Man, you know?
You think a lot of it just has to do with like just the fact that they call them those cowboys and the uniforms and things like that? It's interesting, as I was a fan too, because I was like, when I was a kid, you know, back in the day, like Roger Staubach, that period, you know, it was like junior high and what, elementary school and junior high, you know, and that's when, you know, they used to call them America's team, but they really weren't that. I mean, they weren't dominant. In fact, I mean, like they won two, they had once, you know, before the next generation, they only won two Super Bowls.
Yeah.
And the Steelers won four Super Bowls, right. You know, and yeah, they were usually contended. They usually get to the playoffs, but really they weren't necessarily the best team. Yeah.
But at that time, two was a lot because they only had like 30 or 20 Super Bowls, you know?
Right, but I mean, the Steelers won four.
Yeah, and a great question.
But Dallas was in those games, though. They lost to the Steelers like three times, I think.
Right.
Yeah, they did. But kind of goes back to the Coke, where you've got a product that tastes better, but people still have their loyalty, at least for, you know, a generation or so. Well, the same with the Cowboys. But
you know what else, the Cowboys had, though? The Cowboys had two other things going for them. One was a major thing was the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders were marketed heavily, and they had very creative uniforms that other teams really couldn't match. And so, you know, listen, there was a lot of strong marketing behind that. So I think you have to give credit to that. But I think, they like, to Vinny's point, they weren't the best, but they were good, you know? And they had an iconic coach in Tom Landry, the hat and everything. They were like good TV. You know, Roger Staubach was at the time when they still revered, like, you know, military people, he was a military guy, you know, and he had spent 5 years in the military before he was a Heisman Trophy winner, spent 5 years in the military and then came and played. People love that, you know.
But so maybe I'm asking something, is it something hardwired in the brain, in the reptilian part of the brain, where we have this desire to root for something and it's not analytical. It's an emotional, you know, as far as Coke or the Cowboys or. Are you still there, Chris? I don't know if you froze up. Let me move pivot. You want to chime in, Vinny?
Hardwired in the brain, and that's pretty. I mean, that's pretty strong. I'm not sure what it would be that would be hardwired, but yeah, I can see. Certain identification, I mean, just some sort of tendency towards identification, but not necessarily towards branding. I mean, that could be a format it takes. It could be just some sort of identification with your tribe or something that gets, you kind of see how that translates into loyalty to local sports team. Mm-hmm. But then it starts to, there are different twists on it then where it's just like, yeah, they're not even loyal to their own. I mean, I think there was a time when like, most of the Yankees were people that grew up in New York, right? I mean, the players themselves were local origin, right? To a large extent. And there was more loyalty to the city. You didn't have Los Angeles Rams and Anaheim Rams and then, you know, Carolina Rams. And also, I mean, you didn't have people, you know, right now there's not much identification with the city anymore that they belong to, except for Dallas. Dallas would be an exception, but I mean, there's some exceptions, but.
Well, I could be wrong, but I think the Yankees are still the most valuable brand as far as baseball teams. And then, you know, the Cowboys are NFL and basketball. I think it might be the Lakers, or at least it was for a while. But I don't know if Chris is back on, but the, like you mentioned, and this goes back to the Roman times and with Colosseum, where you've got these all these hundreds or thousands of Romans cheering on the gladiators there in the Colosseum. Were there's so is there something intrinsic to the DNA of humans is to want to identify with some type of movement?
Were they cheering on gladiators? Were they loyal to particular gladiators though, or was that really were they loyal to particular fight? I don't know. Were they loyal to particular fighters or something, or were they just like seeing a good fight? Or
I'm assuming if somebody was they well, if, this is the movie with Russell Crowe, but he says to win the crowd. So I'm assuming, I'm not a historian here, but that there are some gladiators that they really were favorites of the crowd. But the is I think you're back on, Chris. The is there my question was, is there something in wired to the brain, maybe the reptilian part of the brain, where we identify and have this huge emotional connection for really not having necessarily rational reasons for that, and it's durable.
I think, in terms of the gladiators, my understanding is what I've heard is that actually gladiators did have a following, and that they, when you were a successful gladiator, they would allow you to keep fighting. They wouldn't want you to die because so, and you could have a career as a gladiator, though it's very dangerous, obviously. I think it is rational, actually, and that is, it's team building is what I think we're talking about, and that human beings have a remarkable ability to build a team. Actually, it's funny, if you watch ants, right? If you ever, when you were a kid, you'd watch ants, and ants, they'll be going about their business, but they kind of bump into each other, and they look like for very momentarily they communicate something. You ever notice that? Like when ants are like going in different directions on the same like little road or whatever. So like every ant, they almost bump into and they do some kind of form of communication and they move on and they keep. And I think human beings are very, I mean, one of the things that's profound about human beings is if you can speak the same language or even a little bit of the same language, you can walk into, a gas station anywhere in the world and say, I like this gas. You know what I'm trying to say? I mean, you don't have, there's nothing special you have to be able to do. We can all talk to each other. We've been compared to a super colony of ants. Which is to say, when you say a colony, ants will never attack ants of the same type. Okay? They only fight ants of a different type. So what people have said is human beings represent a super colony, basically of a type. And so, but the profound thing is that, we can, if you and I get on a plane tomorrow and we go to Piccadilly Square or something, right? Or we go to Greece, it doesn't matter. We could have a conversation with whoever's there. We can go to China, we have, if we speak the language, at all, we can talk about politics. It's like there's no barrier other than the actual language barrier. Somehow, we can laugh, joke, talk about the same. I mean, I don't know if you've ever watched the soap opera. They talk about the same things in every language. I've watched a Korean soap opera with subtitles, like exactly the same. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that this, so I guess fundamentally what makes people strong is their ability to form attachments very quickly. And, if someone's, if you, if it's a company meeting, right, there's 1,000 employees and they say, okay, randomly we're going to make you, teams of 10, people will say, okay, yeah, we're the green team, right? We're going to beat those guys. That is the, that's the human mentality, right? We will instantly form attachments to the group and instantly form a rivalry with the others. And we want to win. And I think that's very adaptive. I think that's how people survive. And so I think that what we do with sports to some extent, if we sublimate that, because it can have, it can also be harnessed for things like a war, right? Which are very destructive. But I think that, I sometimes you would say to myself, I wonder why they don't just solve conflicts by having people field a soccer team. Now maybe it might get pretty gnarly out there, right? If people are fighting for something important, like who's going to have the rights to this port, right? But if you had a, if you have your soccer team go out there and play, well, maybe that's as good as way of any of settling a dispute. Maybe it's as good as a war. And the team that wins, they get the port. But I think that, so I think to some extent, this is what sports is. It's the ability to take these impulses to compete against others and say, you know what, let's not have to compete again in trade. Like the Germans and the British may not want to compete in, forget the British because they did Brexit. The French and the Germans might want to collaborate on most things and cooperate more than they want to compete with each other these days, right? So you say, you know what, but we can still play each other in sports. We can still root for the French team versus the German team. And maybe that's, that's good, you know, because that way you don't, there's somebody Yahoo isn't out there saying, you know what, we really need to attack the Germans, okay, we really need to attack the French. No, we can cooperate, and if we feel like in our competitive impulse can be satisfied with, you know, watching the World Cup every 4 years.
Does that explain the durability of why people stay for a few generations with a certain beverage brand or sports brand or apparel brand? I mean, you can go on down the line. There's is it part and parcel of the human condition to stay with something for a long period of time, a generation? You see all these companies where they have huge market share, and, you know, obviously at some point they go away.
Yeah. So I know a guy who's from Pakistan. He grew up in Dubai. Yeah, Dubai. And his dad's from Pakistan, his mom's from India. And he came to America for college. And this guy's a really interesting guy because for whatever reason, he invested the time in learning about American football. He knows it quite well. And he ended up going to a lot of schools like in the South, and where football is very important. And later on, like Michigan and Ohio State as well. So, or they're all, where football is also very important. And he found that being able to talk about football was like amazing door opener for him, right? Even though he's from out of the country, he could talk football and people would be happy to talk to him. So I think there's something very reinforcing about knowing something about these teams. If you watch these teams year after year, you know the new players, and you knowing something is reinforcing, right? Being able to talk about it with some other people, being able to talk about the history of it, right? Like we were talking about earlier. Well, I mean, Vinny was saying, well, they only won two Super Bowls, but he only knows that because he invested the time back then to know about it, right? So now it has value today because it's valuable to this conversation. I did go to a school one point where we basically didn't watch TV for a couple of years. And one thing that, you know, that I didn't realize until then was how much a roster turns over year to year. So 2 years of not watching a sport and you turn it back on and you don't know who the players are. And I was really shocked by that. And that's when I realized how much of it is, you know, basically programming, right? Because when you are forced to stop doing it, you're not getting that positive feedback loop is broken. And suddenly it's like, you know what? I could watch the game or I could just do something else. Your connection to it can be broken by not allowing you to participate in watching it or in that sense. So not knowing the players. Knowing the players is partly why you watch. Right? Oh, that's so-and-so. He made a great play like that last week.
Yeah.
Right? Because you want – so I think, you know, so I think this is a big part of it. And I think that, you know, I think these attachments aren't really so durable as they are – constantly rebuilt.
What are your thoughts, Vinny? I mean, there's patterns you can extend to different industries where something will be consistent for a generation or longer. Is it something part of the wiring of how we're made up?
Well, yeah, I mean, right. So it's, yeah, I guess there's like Team Pepsi and Team Coke also in a sense, or, you know, like you say, the part of the family, but there are just degrees of loyalty and it's just, I wouldn't say hardwired though. I think that's just too strong. I mean, there are definite tendencies. I just think it's very adaptable. Like Chris was saying, hardwired things would just have to be like, or the things that are close to hardwired things are being loyal to someone, having some sort of affinity with someone that speaks your language, for example. That would be, you know, that's a pretty hard one to break. I wouldn't say it's hardwired completely, but that's pretty deeply ingrained in us. So, I mean, I would think there's some biological basis to, I mean, like loyalty to your tribe or something, but the fundamental part of that would be language, I would think, or just a fundamental part of that. So, but I would say like some sort of tribal loyalty would be the common theme. I mean, that I can see being, pretty much hardwired, is that people are loyal at least initially to their tribes, but then, you know, it's not hardwired because eventually you might outgrow it. You can learn, I mean, if you start thinking more abstractly, you know, like supposedly Socrates said something like, I'm a citizen of the world. I mean, it's not exactly, you know, it's something advanced or anything, not like something that appeared in late culture necessarily either. It's just I mean, the brain is remarkably malleable also. It's just like, so I mean, you can rewire, I mean, you can like, it's just amazing how much we can considering that we have the same brain as ancestors from prehistory, it's amazing how different we are in many ways, and how varied our cultures are, how varied individuals are compared to how they were maybe 10, 20, 30,000 years ago.
Is that the closest connector, though, as far as a family that's Coke or Pepsi? Or I remember in the 80s, it was, you know, Ford or your Chevy family, or this allegiance to a particular sports team or a particular corporate brand in all different sectors. Is that the closest connector as far as tribalism?
Well, for at least for the thing about this, about sports and brand, I don't know so much. Brand, that's a little more complicated, I think, because it's not necessarily that you're loyal to Pepsi or Coke. You just might be used to one thing, but then you might also have this, like, you might associate it with family. And if you associate with family, then it's second, you could say it's second, it derives, it's the loyalty is secondary to your loyalty to family or something, right? So that would be one explanation. But I mean, so I don't know though that, I mean, things like what we're talking about, like loyalty to beers and stuff like that, I don't know if that's going to easily map onto loyalty to your tribe. You know, it's not like exactly, you know what I mean? It's not.
Well, what's the closest connector for people attaching themselves to a particular corporate brand or just branding in general? I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah, that is a good question. I don't know if there's going to be a single one. A lot of it might just be familiarity. People get attached to certain things, certain colors, certain writers, patterns, basically. So I don't know.
Because the brain's a pattern-seeking machine? Is that one reason? So... Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say familiarity. I mean, people do like routine. I mean, I'd say familiarity is quite a bit. I mean, it's just like also, if you know you like Coke, you might not want to try Pepsi. You know, you don't necessarily know that you like Coke better than Pepsi, or that you couldn't go to like Pepsi after drinking it for a while, or that you wouldn't drink it over orange juice if you're just a hard soda drinker, you know. But if you're used to drinking Coke and you know that you're going to like it, you might just keep doing it, and then you feel like you're loyal to it. But you know, that doesn't necessarily mean you think it's the best or anything like that, or that you're incapable of becoming accustomed to something else. So, I mean, part of it is just, I think, habituation and familiarity, I think, is part of it.
And then, Chris, if we pivot from sports just to brands in general, what are your thoughts as far as from a neuroscience perspective and any other things you want to add?
I mean, I think the main driver of some of this stuff is fun. I think people enjoy being able to say our team is better than your team. And, you know, and that's, I mean, if you, I went to Alabama for a wedding and I didn't realize that football season was all year round in Alabama, and that Auburn, Alabama was like, it's like the only game that counts. And that's what they're, I mean, if you go to McDonald's in the middle of the summertime, it's all about Auburn, Alabama inside the McDonald's. I mean, everything is Auburn, Alabama. I think they mainly do it because it's fun, right? To have that rivalry, you know, and even in the same family, you know, mom might root for Auburn, dad might root for Alabama. So I think people enjoy playing that kind of that more than anything else. It's fun. I do think, though, that there are other reasons why people do it. I mean, it can have other meaning. At one point, I don't know if it's still true, but at one point it seemed that in Germany, for example, the kind of car you bought, whether it was a BMW or Volkswagen or Mercedes, was reflective of your social or your professional caste. So it wasn't based on how much money the car cost, but rather if you were a certain profession, you're going to buy a Mercedes. If you were a blue collar worker, for example, maybe you're going to buy a Volkswagen. It could be a very expensive Volkswagen, but regardless, so that there was an overlay between the kind of vehicle you bought and your social position. I won't call it caste, or I shouldn't call it caste. I shouldn't call it rank, but your social position. So I think that That is there. And I think that there's also the case that a lot of people that were loyal to, these loyalties grew out of, you know, like, why are we loyal to Ford? Because granddad worked at the Ford plant, right? Ford paid the bills in their mind, right? Working for Ford. So they had that loyalty, and that passes down. I do think that, so sometimes I think it's because of, there was an actual economic connection or some kind of affiliation with the brand. Sometimes it's just because, and then one last driver, I think, of brand of affiliation is the values that the brand attempts to promote. So, for example, I mean, I'm just remembering, one jumps in my mind all of a sudden. There used to be something called a company called Benetton. I think it was a clothing company, and they had United Colors of Benetton. They had a very active, like, campaign bait that was called for years. But what was interesting is some people liked it and some people hated it. Okay, so there are some times where a company will pick. You know, with Marlboro, the cigarette brand, it was this rugged independence, right? The Marlboro man, you know, he's out there on his, he's a cowboy, he's out there on his own. Sadly, the Marlboro man got cancer. But, you know, people who said, yeah, I'm a rugged independent person, I'm a Marlboro man, right? So I think advertising is very powerful. I think they know what they're doing with that sort of thing. It's well understood how to do that at this point. I think that, you know, there are a lot of reasons, but I think at the end, most people, I think the vast majority of people do it sort of tongue in cheek, right? They don't really hate you because you have a different cigarette brand or you like a different team. You know, most normal people feel like it's all in good fun, right? And so they're happy for you to make fun of their car, and they can make fun of your car for what they know that's a weakness in your car. And I think that that's, but I do think the ability of people to build teams quickly and to become competitive is a secret of a lot of human success, because a lot of our success is not just from the fact that we're collaborating, but because we want to be better than the other group, right? You know, the Russians put up Sputnik? Well, we better put a lot of money into going to the moon, right? We would never have gone to the moon had it not been for the Russians being the first in space. You know, maybe not never, maybe never is the wrong word, but we could have waited a really long time if the Russians hadn't done something. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's really helpful to people to have that healthy level of competition. But at your base level, I think the engineers at NASA and then engineers at Russia and in the Russian, whatever the space agency was in Russia at that time, were actually rooting for each other, right? They really wanted to both. They really wanted to see each other be successful. So I think that's really cool. That's special. Something special about being a human being, perhaps. And I think a big part of how people have success.
But if we go down into the brain chemistry or the biochemistry of the chemistry of the brain, the dopamine release. You can think of certain companies where you mentioned cigarettes. Well, I don't know if it's a dopamine, but obviously there's an addiction there. Or if you, in present day, like Instagram, Facebook, there's been articles I've read where people get a dopamine release when they get a like on their posting. So this is something that's embedded in our brain chemistry, and these Snapchat and other companies have tapped into this. And so, yeah.
What are your thoughts? It's interesting you mentioned that, because the nicotine, they did identify a dopamine connection. Initially, I don't think they did, but. Yeah, initially it was kind of mysterious. So there was this, they had a strong affinity for acetylcholine receptors, like so strong that they call them nicotinic receptors, right? Because these particular class of acetylcholine receptors, but that doesn't really explain why it would give you a high. Then they identify a dopamine connection. And then I think the delivery of smoking probably helps quite a bit too, because it's so instant, you know, it's so immediate.
But that's, I think that another fascinating follow-up question as far as how you get those, the dominant brands of today and in the future, where it gets into the chemistry of the brain. And what are your thoughts on that, Chris?
I said earlier, I think that companies are well aware, advertising companies are well aware of how to activate, you know, how to take advantage of that system. So I don't know if there's anything that new companies in the future are going to know that the companies don't know now about how to build that level of addiction. You know, I mean, I like to think in terms of addiction. This is a little off, but it is connected, I suppose. I like to think in terms of, you know, the slot machine. You know, slot machine is classic in that it's a non-fixed reward schedule, right? It's equivalent to the rat in the cage tapping the bar and not knowing when it's going to deliver a treat. That is the most addicting reward schedule. You know, a fixed reward schedule, every two taps, every five taps, every tap, that's not nearly as rewarding as I don't know when it's going to hit.
Right. They model that when you can really hit big. I mean, they model it like when they're trying to model drug addiction, you know, it's just like, you wonder why people put themselves through so much torment, but then they can reproduce it to some extent. It's not just modeling with rats, but then it kind of can apply to other things like gambling. I mean, where a big win will be such a powerful reward that people will endure all sorts of incremental losses that add up to be much worse than the big win. But that one big win or that one big high is so powerful, it just keeps coming back for more.
Right. And sometimes that reward is praise. You know, I read your what you said out earlier about making mistakes. And I remember that line, to err is human, but to forgive is divine. And I thought, where did that come from? So I looked it up. And actually, that the essay that is found is all about, it's an essay about, it's critiquing who are men of wit, you know, and in there, in that essay, one of the things he talks about is how people will do anything for praise, you know, but it's that same thing. It's the reward system that's being activated. But you know what? It has some interesting. So I think what happens is your affiliation with the brand can be, again, it's a positive feedback loop. You wear it. Someone says they like it, right? So you go buy another one, and then someone says they like that, right? So you build this positive feedback loop. But you know, there are some ways where that can be very, I think, problematic in society. For example, why would a police officer profile people and stop people that have not, when he has no probable cause, right? Which is what the, which is required to have to stop somebody. And well, the reason is they might get lucky. So let's say a police officer just stops people randomly, hoping he's going to find something in the vehicle. Okay, call it a police officer on the street, or call it a highway patrolman, whatever it is. I'm just going to pull. So he has a strong addictive, the scenario is strongly addictive, where for him to randomly stop people, because every once in a while he finds something, and then he gets patted on the back, and he's a great police officer, he's a great cop, because he found this contraband, right? Or somebody was, So we have to be aware of this, and we have to, if you don't want a police officer to be strongly incentivized and addicted even to bad policing, then you have to tell them in advance, right? You have to warn them. Look, you know, we know this is what happens to you. You start to get addicted to catching the guy who's selling marijuana, so you start pulling over people who didn't do anything. So I think this stuff is operant in every aspect of, I think, our lives, but when you know about it, then you have some sort of armor and defense against it. If you don't know about it, then you're essentially, you know, you're the rat in the cage, you know, and so you're just going to respond and react. And this is why I think it's very important that you, I mean, I think we talked about this a long time ago in the context of the stuff in Minneapolis, but you know, I looked at it. Police officers have like 60 hours dedicating to like weapons training and like 7 or 8 hours dedicating to the Constitution. That should be reversed, right? Because if you give them 60 hours of weapons training, then what you're telling them is you're here to use your weapon. Even though 99% of police officers, I think they say never have to draw their weapon in the line of duty, right? But you're telling them it's about your weapon. Because that, and then maybe that's why they're there. And then you end up attracting people who want to go there to shoot things and shoot off their gun, as opposed to attracting people who want to be there to enforce the law and see if it's properly carried out. So the emphasis we put on things is very important. How we prioritize things, whether explicitly or implicitly, and how we and recognizing that our dopamine reward system, as you point out, is highly accessible in lots of ways, including just by praise. And so hopefully what happens is, it unfortunately the problem is, for us to know this stuff takes a lot of time, right? We have to be educated on it. Maybe we should teach people this in high school. I think a great way to teach something in high school, and you can bring them a lot of topics, but we don't really teach it in high school. So when are you going to teach people this stuff? If you don't teach people this stuff, they don't think about it. And so they think about the wrong things, or they don't consider so many of these influences were very powerful drivers of human behavior, and maybe more powerful than the ones we think about typically.
Yeah, and that article that I sent out where it talks about for our millions of listeners out there, there's different errors in at least in the medical profession, where there's, I think the article said, technical, judgmental, and normative. The interesting point is that I think the article that was truncated or whatever I cut and pasted, but they go on to say that if you admit a judgmental or maybe a technical error, and you're a doctor, Chris, you can correct me here, that if you admit it very rapidly, then you can keep your job. But on the normative, and they gave an example of this doctor where he would say, you came into the hospital and you have this you have some kind of reaction, so he prescribes you penicillin, and then the guy ends up breaking out and has this awful reaction. And then of course the first question is, did you ask the patient, do you have any allergies, are you allergic to penicillin? Now if this guy commits or girl commits a normative error there, then, and he fabricates and says, oh yeah, no, I asked. And then you find out later where if you research this particular person, he has a very long history of normative errors. And in the medical profession, you want to get those out right away, and unless he's really good at deception. Whereas, we've had a discussion in the past, is whenever the whole George Floyd thing came about, where I think the police unions are way too powerful, and there's you look at all the different articles out there that you can commit if you take the normative from medicine over into police, where you can make up things. You're not going to lose your job, and even if you do lose your job, you just have to go to the town 20 miles away. It's not you're not going to be banned from the industry. Now maybe that's going to start changing here, but the normative is, you stamp that out. They seem to stamp that out very harshly, which is what you want from society in the medical profession, but they don't do that in the at least in the United States, in the police profession.
Yeah, I saw that kind of capsule that you sent out and just skimmed it, but that's an interesting topic in itself, is errors.
Okay, well, yeah, we can talk about that next, or I can stop recording now, but we can
it's definitely worth talking about in a whole session.
Yeah. I would like to talk a couple of topics in the future. It is incentives and then errors. I think
these are something like that, where like you mentioned that the astronauts at NASA, I mean, they had, yeah, I mean, they were loyal to their country, and they also probably felt some sort of camaraderie with the astronauts, the astronauts, people in the space program in Russia, you know, because there's some camaraderie. Hey, we're both astronauts, we're all astronauts. Well, and then there was also, I mean, there's a sense of, you know, landing on the moon, there's just like, you know, giant step for mankind. So there's a broader camaraderie in that sense. You know, there was, you know, fierce, more than just rivalry, of course, this ideological conflict between the United States and Soviet Union. But, and then with sports also, I mean, it's just like, yeah, you might be a fan of a particular team, but you also, you know, you have certain camaraderie with the fact that the person's a sports, I mean, you're both football fans, and you can, like you said, talk to them at parties or something like that. It's like, hey, they're not football fans. We're fans of rival teams. This is fun now. We can talk about this. We can argue about which team is better, which team, you know, should be considered better, which team should have won this game or that game.
Right.
Or which team got bad. You know, it's like all of a sudden there's this camaraderie in that, even in the rivalry, within the rivalry, or even largely by virtue of the rivalry, there can be camaraderie. I think you said, or with the sports players. I mean, it's just like, yeah, we're competitors, but we're also, you know, we're both football players. No one else is going to understand what we go through, you know, being aching all the time, whatever, or hardly anybody else is going to see, and the fans aren't going to understand what it's like to be involved with the kind of pressure under, whatever it is. I mean, I'm just saying they have a lot in common with each other, and there can be that mutual respect a lot of times, right, too. So, I mean, it's just so complicated. So, I mean, I was talking about culture and language, but it's nothing that can be simply reduced. That's all. It just gets very complicated. You have a complex interplay of factors. So. It's just nothing simple. And I mean, it's just nothing simple. It's very complicated.
I think though, it's one of the things that makes life fun, right? Is to be able to root for your team and against the other team.
Yeah, definitely. We can start wrapping up. Just stop. But yeah, so I think that'd be a good topic maybe for next week as far as errors. And then I'll send out an email. And then are there any, do you want to just cover what types of errors would you like to cover, Vinny?
Every time we do a, I mean,